The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
The Book of Serenity, Case 4. As the World Honored One was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Indra, the emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The World Honored One smiled. So this koan comes from a collection called the Book of Serenity, and it was compiled by the same teacher, our ancestor, Hongzhe, who we read from earlier today in the liturgy service. Hongzhe put together 100 stories about the Great Way, as we sometimes call our practice. And in putting together these stories, he also wrote poems commenting on each one of the stories. He was a person who was devoted to the practice of sitting as the source of all of our insights, all of our understandings of what it means to be a person of the way, a person of Zen. So when we look into this collection, which we use in our koan study in Boundless Way, this collection from the Soto tradition, which is one of two of the strands that weave together to form Boundless Way, we receive the story as a pointer to something that can't be understood by the ordinary discursive mind. And like with all good stories, they begin to suggest, this story in particular, I think, begins to suggest a way of understanding the world that is magical, mythological, outside of the ordinary way of understanding time and space and objects and our relationship to objects. This collection of 100 koans and the verses that Hongzhe put together was lost at a certain point, and it was put back together almost 100 years later by another teacher named Wan Song. Both Wan Song and Hongzhe were Chinese teachers. I think they lived about 12th, 13th century, same time as Dogen in Japan, although Dogen probably, he met one of the Dharma heirs, I think, but he never met them directly. And Wan Song, who put this together, made introductions to all the cases and also commentaries. And I'm going to just read you Wan Song's introduction to this case as well as Hongzhe's poem so that you can get a sense of how vast, really, this little story can be taken hold of by our own experience of the words that are not anything in themselves beyond words, and also are profound pointers to something that's always here, but isn't always realized. I think most of you know that the word Buddha means the one who is awake. And the Buddha of our time, that is the one who lived 2,600 years ago, was called Shakyamuni Buddha. As you may have noticed during our dedication to our ancestors, there were 7 Buddhas who came before him through vast numbers of years, distant past. All of these Buddhas were in the original understanding of Buddhism, historical or maybe ahistorical, that is outside of history, figures, characters. And in Zen practice, especially, we talk a lot about how, this is from the Mahayana teachings that we're embedded in, the great vehicle, how there is really no past or present or future. The Buddhas of the past, the seven ancient Buddhas, we call them, and Shakyamuni himself is someone who resides outside of space and time. He's here with us right now, not just in the form of a statue that might be decorating our space, but in the form of every single thing arising and falling away. The awakened nature of the universe resonates with the Buddha's presence, we say in the Mahayana. So we don't have to get stuck in ideas about this happened a long time ago. This is happening now. And Wansong points this out, and then Hungjir talks about it in a slightly different way in his poem. So here's Wansong's introduction. He says, as soon as a single mote of dust arises, the whole earth is contained therein. With a single horse and a single lance, the land is extended. Who is this person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? Who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? And here's the case again. As the World Honored One was walking with the congregation, the World Honored One, of course, is the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. He pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Sometimes this is translated as temple. I like both meanings of whatever this word was originally in Chinese. A sanctuary, a place to sit and practice that is the whole world, we might say, embracing us with care, a place to be. At the distant temple bell, Sesshin, there's something really wonderful about this teaching, because if we thought that the temple or the sanctuary was in some specific small place, what we learn from these teachings is that it actually extends everywhere, and that's our emphasis here at this Sesshin. And then the emperor of the gods comes along, Indra. He's walking with Shakyamuni Buddha, apparently, the god Indra, who is a Hindu god worshipped in many countries still as the main god of all the different gods in the Hindu tradition. He took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." And the World Honored One, the Buddha, smiled. And here's Hongzhi's verse commentary. The boundless spring on the hundred plants. Picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly. The 16-foot tall golden body, a collection of virtuous qualities, casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. Able to be master in the dusts from outside creation, a guest shows up. Everywhere, life is sufficient in its way. Everywhere, life is sufficient in its way, no matter if one is not as clever as others. In a slightly different translation, this last line says, don't compare yourself to others. So this poem, it contains a few things that might be confusing, as all of these poems and commentaries and koans do. But one thing you need to know is the 16-foot tall golden body is a reference to the Buddha, a reference to a kind of legendary quality of Buddhas, all the Buddhas, our Buddha and the seven Buddhas who preceded him, appear as 16-foot tall golden bodies, probably the best player on the Buddha basketball team. And the red dust that's referred here, he casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. That's the dust of the ordinary world. All of the things that we sometimes think are not the awakened state, the things we exclude in the teachings of the Mahayana, of the Great Vehicle, we say everything without exception is this wondrous quality that Hongjer talks about in some of the readings we talked about earlier, we read earlier. The red dust is the things we maybe consider outside of what our narrow ideas of awakening include. So the red dust could include all the different emotions that torment us, the thoughts that take us away, garbage and squalor, suffering, and all of the difficulties that the world is constantly full of. The great awakening of the Buddha, of our Buddha, was about seeing that the world actually is full of suffering, but that this is not a problem. This is the way things are. So the red dusts are included, and Hongjer says that he's able to be the master in the dusts. That is, that really engaging in the world as it is not a problem. In fact, it's what's required of those of us who practice sincerely. Everywhere, Hongjer says, life is sufficient in its way. And then he says, don't compare yourself to other people. Don't think that you are not sufficient, because those of us who are used to looking at ourselves as falling short think other people know more than we do. Nobody knows more than you do. You only can know what you experience. And so taking these directions from our ancestors here, our great ancestor Hongjer, our great ancestor Wansong, we begin to taste maybe what it would be like to live in a world where everything is sufficient. Everything is full of the Dharma, that is the teachings, the way things are. According to Wansong, this koan is a reflection, a mirror of something that happened millennia before the life of the Buddha. One of the ancient Buddhas was named Dipankara, and he encountered the Buddha in a previous lifetime when the Buddha was a bodhisattva, I guess you might say. He wasn't even quite that yet, according to the stories of rebirth that we call the Jataka tales. Sometimes there are stories about the Buddha as a previous incarnation as an animal. Many amazing stories. These are published now as children's tales because they are delightful tales, fantasies, mythology, really fairy tales about the possibility of waking up over and over and over again. Because we're Zen practitioners, we don't put a lot of emphasis on rebirth and reincarnation. But you can hear these stories, this mythological dream realm, we might say. These are the bliss body of the Buddha, the dream body of the Buddha, the way things show up as suggestive stories and tales to inspire us. And remember that in the Mahayana, the Buddha is outside of space and time. So all of these things are happening right now. When we study koans, we're asked to be all the characters we encounter, to imagine being and then actually be the person in this story, whatever the story is. There's the Buddha walking along, our current Shakyamuni Buddha of this age, and he's somehow got Indra, the chief god of the Hindus, walking along with him. This is a signal that we know that we're in a realm of mystery. How could the god, this god Indra, Shakadevendra as he's sometimes called, how could he be with the Buddha? But he plays a very important role in this story, which we'll get back to in a moment. The story about Dipankara is that he was walking along one day with his Sangha, and he encountered the Buddha in a previous incarnation. At that time, the Buddha was a renunciate. He was someone who was wandering around begging for a living, and he had let his hair grow long and matted. He was dirty and not very proper looking person, we might say, in this ancient time that story's from. And Dipankara was walking along, and there was a puddle in front of him. And the previous incarnation of the Buddha, this wandering ascetic with his long matted hair, recognized him for who he was, an awakened one. And when he saw that, he rushed forward and threw himself down and put his hair covering the puddle. He must have had a lot of hair for him to be able to do this. And we can imagine this too. You can imagine yourself maybe as suddenly seeing a person that looked maybe at first like an ordinary person walking along, and then suddenly you realize, oh, this is someone that I need to bow to. I need to recognize as someone that I could learn from. And this is what this previous incarnation of the Buddha did. And Dipankara was very touched. He walked over the puddle, stepping on his hair, the ascetic's hair. And then when he had crossed to the other side of the puddle, he made a prediction. He said, "You will someday be a Buddha yourself." In a way, from the Zen perspective, we need to understand that he was already a Buddha. This was the sudden action of a Buddha. This was the no hesitation moment. And someone else who was around in the Sangha of the Dipankara Buddha at the time said, recognized the ascetic's great deed and said, "Indeed, you will be someone who, through your action of no hesitation, will become a leader of human beings, taking us all into the great way." So Wansong, who's commenting and brings up this story of Dipankara in his commentary, is saying, here we are now, millennia later, the same action is happening. No hesitation, Indra, a god, hearing that the Buddha thinks this is a good place to build a temple or a sanctuary, immediately plucks a blade of grass. Again, this is in the fantasy realm. How could planting a blade of grass in the ground establish a sanctuary for the practice, establish a temple? There's a very sweet line later in one of Wansong's commentaries on the story. He says, Indra struck a blade of grass in the ground, said, "The sanctuary is built." Wansong says, "Repairs won't be easy." I think one of the reasons I love that little comment is that building a sanctuary, building a temple, is complex. But in the action of the moment, we don't see all the repercussions of what we do. In Zen practice, we really value throwing yourself down in a puddle. Well, we don't really recommend that anymore. But the spirit of that pre-Buddha helping Dipankara Buddha cross the puddle, the spirit of Indra planting the blade of grass, and suddenly there we are. Everything is in the imaginary world complete. One of the things that we have to do when we practice Zen is not exactly set aside our discursive mind, because the discursive mind is a wonderful friend and companion to us. It helps us turn our computer on and get connected to the sesshin, for example. It helps us remember that we need to eat and drink and take care of ourselves. It's a good companion. And we also have to be able to live in a world that is much bigger than what we sometimes call consensus reality. This koan is based on non-consensual reality, an understanding about being free from time and space, as all of these Buddhas and gods and characters in these stories are, and unbelievably, as we ourselves are. Hongzhi knew this intimately, again and again, in his teachings in the Book of Serenity, and in his poetry, and in many of his discourses that he gave as talks to his own Sangha. He points again and again and again to how marvelous the world is. He doesn't mean that some little pieces of it are marvelous. He means that everything, everything without exception, is wondrous, marvelous. We sometimes favor one part of our experience after the other. Right now, it's a beautiful spring day in Worcester. It's been raining, and the ground smells amazing, and the flowers are coming to bloom. We have a pear tree and an azalea right outside our window here, and when I settle down into my seat, the last thing I see is the white blossoms of the pear tree, and just behind it, the reddish pink blossoms of the azalea bush. But if I were to think that that is what is important, and of course it's beautiful, I would miss a great deal of what happens in life. Also, doing the dishes and putting food into the compost and scrubbing and walking around and going to the bathroom and noticing what comes out of my body and then what comes into my body, this too is all of the wondrousness that Hongzhi is pointing to. All of the phenomena of the universe don't fall into categories of good or bad, secular or spiritual, right or wrong. And our job, in order to know how to act, is to see this for ourselves. The ascetic who threw himself down and put his hair on the puddle was a little bit caught, wasn't he, in thinking Dipankara Buddha shouldn't walk in a muddy puddle. But he was still not a Buddha. He was still not fully awake. And yet that very action, with no hesitation, showed something to Dipankara Buddha, and the very action of the god Indra, of Shakadevendra, planting a blade of grass and saying, here is the sanctuary. And that koan ends with the Buddha smiled, which happens in a number of stories about our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, smiling in recognition about something that encompasses the entire universe, everything without exception, nothing left out, as Hongzhi tells us in some of his writings. We value this because it's unbelievable. And yet, through the practice of sitting, of awakening to our true nature and the true nature of the universe, so important not to make this an intellectual study, but really knowing this for ourselves, tasting it, feeling it, hearing it, smelling it, touching into the heart of reality. This is how we proceed. This is how we continue in our work. As the world honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, this spot is good to build a sanctuary. Indra, emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground and said, the sanctuary is built. The world honored one smiled. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. We're going to enter into a period of Dharma dialogue. So everyone is encouraged to put up your hand and say something. Be like the Bodhisattva throwing himself in the mud, be like Indra planting the blade of grass. No hesitation, even if you don't know what you're going to say. Join in. So we'll start with Beverly.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for the talk. That is, in fact, where I was with this talk. It's just being astounded, on the one hand, by the courage of Indra or the ascetic to do this action, and what I find so amazing is the trust that must be there for someone to be so free to do that. It just knocks me over.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing this forward, because we don't know how it's going to come out. And usually we're trying to play the odds, right? Is it going to be better to do this or better to do that? And I think you correctly catch the spirit of this possibility of acting in a more direct way, doing our best, doing something, and in some ways expressing ourselves fully in a way that's not about controlling the universe, but about giving ourselves away, being of use, not making sure we're right or it's going to come out for us, and such a freedom in that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Beverly, for beginning. And yeah. I forgot to mention that Michael is a Dharma holder. Michael is also responding, as well as David and me.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say how much I appreciated, Beverly, you using the word courage. Courage, there's a root word in core of the heart. This courage is of opening the heart to this, and you have that. You have that courage. It's something that's innate in you, and this practice is what helps us see that.
Thank you. Let's move on to Madhu.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa Roshi. I always appreciate this koan, you know, how it brings forth the Sambhogakaya, the Nirmanakaya, and the Dharmakaya of the moment, and just, you know, brings everything together. And that's what this moment is about. And particularly, I was thinking about how this perspective of like the Sakra Devendra picking up the blade of grass and putting there, when Buddha says this is a perfect place for sanctuary, like I was like, you know, imagining that in my work setting. Like if somebody says something like that, you know, what people do is that they start picking the pros and cons.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Oh, how are we going to do it? We don't have problems, no resources, nothing is possible, you know, barriers, block, you know? And so sometimes when somebody just, you know, does something humorous or just picks up something and does, you know, oh, here it is. Then everybody laughs and it just lightens up everybody's mood. How important that perspective is, especially for work setting or in any setting in this world where like people are so like, you know, hard headed and my way kind of approach.
Well, and I love that you're talking about bringing the spirit into our work life. I worked at the same place you worked, not in the same department, but you know, just the awfulness of the culture there was a constant issue, and bringing the Sambhogakaya, that is the magical realm, into that place, as well as the Dharmakaya, which is the thusness body, and the Nirmanakaya, the activity body, you know, really just doing these things, like all of you who've raised your hands. It lightened everything up when any of us acted from that place, even if it was disapproved of by the administration, didn't matter, right? We knew, because we, like David was saying, if we sit around and try to figure out what will this action result in? And is it the right thing to do? And I don't know. And maybe people will think I'm crazy, or maybe it's stupid, or maybe I'm going to harm somebody. Then we're lost, right? But this just doing it, just putting your hand up, just speaking is what we're training ourselves to do by sitting silently and not speaking. In a way, it allows us to feel all these things. So I love what you said. Thank you, Madhu. Yeah, let's move on to Sean.
Yeah, thank you very much, Melissa, for the talk. I really enjoyed it. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure what to say about it, other than I have two. Well, that's not. I have two thoughts. I have two thoughts. One is what you said about comparing oneself to others, and we all do that from time to time. And in fact, I was just talking about that with someone yesterday, and the person said to me that the comparing oneself to others is the end of joy. And I thought that was really profound and powerful, and I really appreciated and enjoyed that. And then the other thing, as far as planting the blade of grass and how this is a perfect place for a temple, I hope it's okay to say this, but I could, with Easter just passing, I couldn't help but think about what Jesus said when he said, "Destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And of course, he was talking about the body. And I couldn't help but think about the blade of grass, that particular moment and that particular situation being the temple is the body. And no matter where the temple is, no matter what location it's in, it's within us to some extent, maybe to a large extent. And so I couldn't help but think about that.
Well, and appreciate you saying that with the way so many wisdom teachings in the world and so important, I think, that we don't imagine that Zen has some corner on the market. And these other images, these profound practices, so many different ways, and each one of us associates and finds the resonance in the images of our life and of our tradition and of our upbringing. So I love seeing that this body, the temple, doesn't matter, living and dying, we find ourselves right here.
Yeah. Thank you, Sean. Pat.
Thank you for that beautiful talk. And it was so beautiful and so broad, and yet it condensed to one thing you said for me. Everything is sufficient in its own way.
Yes.
And those words didn't go in as words, but it felt like something just exploded.
Yes.
And I thought of what it is to live, to meet each moment with that. Everything is sufficient in its own way. And what opens up, and that's sort of the feeling that I have of, you know, that opening and widening, deepening that you always point to. And that the reading said, facing everything, nothing is excluded, gather it up.
Yeah.
And so it just all tied in so beautiful. But what feels so amazing is this, the visceral sense of it, not the head.
Right.
This visceral sense of this practice and how it opens up and just keeps opening and deepening. So thank you. Beautiful talk.
Thank you. And thank you for saying that, because for me, that was the core of what I wanted to say. And it's a funny thing to say, because wait a minute, no, the discursive mind comes in and says, that's not true. That's just absolutely not true. Come on, how could that be true? You know, and we're gifted right now, there are birds singing outside, and there's also a dog barking. And my mind could go into oh, stop barking, sing more birds. But if everything is sufficient, truly sufficient, then everything is pointing at the Dharma, right? That it's not that things are, we get caught in, I like it, I don't like it. And of course there are, you know, people get killed, people are being bombed, people suffer tremendously. There's garbage and it smells and all this stuff. So that's all true. A part of the mind that says these things are not okay is part of this bigger mind and also has to be valued. The feeling of I don't like the sound of the dog is not a problem, right? It's just, oh yeah, and the pear blossoms, and it's all and, it's not but. And I think you're perceiving, and I think Modu said this too, you know, we talk about the three bodies of Buddha. They're always present in these teachings in various degrees and in our own awakened hearts. Some of us are more used to living in the Nirmanakaya body where we're acting, we're activity people. And it's just, you know, you do the dishes just to wash the dishes, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. That's the whole thing right there. Or this big, big spaciousness, which is the Dharmakaya. And then there's the Sambhogakaya, this magical dream realm that's also part of life. How could this, and underneath it all, I keep thinking, my thought when you were talking, because I heard a little mini Dharma talk in what you said just now, how could it be? How could it be? There's a little wondering, and Hungjer says that very directly. He says, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. Wondering is part of our practice too, not knowing. Being amazed is part of our practice, and Hungjer emphasizes that a lot. So thank you for perceiving that yourself and then re-gifting us with it.
And thanks. Pat, I just love how you are really focused on this nothing, everything is sufficient. Even the feeling that nothing is sufficient, or, you know, there's nothing lacking. Even the deep feeling of lack is not lacking. It's everything. And even our preference, you know, for or against something, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, thank you. Somebody at Boundless Way Temple. Who is it?
It's me.
Oh, great, Zaida.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
loud and clear.
Perfect.
Yes. So I love the beauty of the weaving of poetry, commentaries, different commentaries to illustrate the koan. Thank you for that, Melissa. Beautiful. I just enjoyed and understood the koan much better. I wanted to follow up on something that what Madhu said about, you know, how sometimes we feel certain, you know, certainty about something, and how another person can dampen that certainty by not validating, by finding fault, and how often great, beautiful ideas, beautiful plans are killed in, you know, by another person finding fault, rational fault, right? About this couldn't work because of this and that, you know, so thank you.
Yeah, this finding fault, going back to what Michael just said. So, of course, this finding fault is not something that just happens outside of us. Sometimes we come forward quite clearly and beautifully, and then some other part of us says, who do you think you are? You know, how dare you do that? What do you think, as Melissa was saying, what do you think other people are going to think about you? And sometimes people on the outside give voice to what is in us. I generally find that I'm only really troubled when people say things that live in me too. People can say lots of things, and if there's some clarity and appreciation where I am, I can hear people but don't have to collapse or fall apart. So I think how to come forward, knowing that we will get all kinds of reactions, right? Some people will say, oh, Zaida, you are the most amazing teacher and human being, and you radiate love. And other people will say, oh, Zaida, you're just this and that and so and so. We will get all of those, and we contain all of those. So so this practice, and as we've been talking, I've been thinking so difficult at work to do this, in relationships. And we here in the sanctuary of this retreat get to practice doing this with each breath, right? We're actually cultivating habits of the heart, habits of the mind, new ways of being in the world. And we don't have to wait till the next time we go somewhere else. But here, can you, can I, breathing in, fully breathe in, and breathing out, fully breathe out, not trying to hedge my bets in this way.
One of the things I love about this koan and all the commentaries and poetry associated with it is that, so this was 1,000 years ago in a completely different culture in China, in Song Dynasty China, and still people are talking about making comparisons to other people. You know, I'm not good enough. This is a commentary from it's in the poem from Hongzhi, a brilliant, brilliant teacher. And yet he knows this intimately, as we all do. And I've been very inspired lately. I've been reading an autobiography by a woman who named Helen Twerkoff, who founded Tricycle magazine. Some of you might know Tricycle. And when she started, she got lots of criticism. Oh my goodness. Just, what are you doing making a magazine about Buddhism, and you're going to talk about three different kinds of Buddhism all in one magazine, and it's a terrible name. And she actually said that when it was first published, it was put in the bicycle and motorcycle sections of the bookstores. I love that. And she thought, well, so maybe some motorcycle people will pick it up and read it and go, oh, this is teaching. So anyway, but you know, she's very clear about how difficult it was. This was in the 1990s, as a woman, as a person who didn't know much about business, everyone gave her advice. Everyone told her where she was wrong. Dharma teachers and business people and writers. But she knew, she kept going. And her core teachers, she had Tibetan teachers and Zen teachers who she consulted with, kept saying, yep, keep going. Who cares what other people think? Amazing, because we do care what other people think. It's so hurtful when somebody says that was a terrible Dharma talk, or, you know, those of you who've said that was a great Dharma talk. There it is again. It pulls at the heart, good and bad, right and wrong. It's just so natural and so built into our genetic code for survival. And so to see where that gets in our way, that's all we're looking at here. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Zaida. Anne.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's the time for spring ephemerals, which are small flowers that come up in the woods, and they're only there in the spring, and then they go away. And one of them is called the Canada Mayflower. And it comes in two forms. And one of the forms is a regular little flower, it's white, and the other is a single leaf. And you look along the ground in the forest, and there's a single leaf coming out all by itself, just one. And that's the whole form. And it's sort of breathtaking. You're used to thinking of perennial plants, which they are, as like having stems and roots and leaves. And it's not. It's a single leaf all by itself. It's it's daunting and really wonderful. And the talk reminded me of it.
Yeah. Well, and I love the ephemeral nature, and maybe how to walk in the woods, how to walk in the world, how to see. So easy to walk by looking for something bigger, or looking for the full plant. This is only, but I think as we slow down and as we look and appreciate, we can begin to see When Pat was talking, I was thinking about listening with the ears of the heart, we say sometimes. So in the Dharma talk, how do we listen from our heart? Maybe same way outdoors in the forest or other places. How do we see with the eyes of the heart? See that way that you can be astonished and delighted and in awe. A single leaf comes up, and Anne and David are both amazed.
Thank you, Anne. Beautiful. Jenny.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa. When you were talking about just everyday actions and seeing perfection in that, and I identify with that, I guess. Like, I see myself as a person who can find joy in the ordinary, and I'm coming off of 2 weeks of sickness, and I'm just noticing all this objecting, even though I know better. This a couple of days ago, it was like, well, this just will not do, being thirsty and unable to swallow. This is just yep. Not okay with me. And then that goes away. And today it's like my hearing's all messed up and I can't hear the rain. And I'm a person who finds joy in hearing the rain. What if I can't hear the rain again? And just noticing it's the same thing again and again, no matter how trivial.
Right.
It's just this objecting.
Something you just said, Jenny, I'm a person who.
Yeah, this identifying. Yeah.
Right. That's what gets us in trouble. You know, when we have these awakening experiences, what we're awakening to is the wonder of maybe not. You know, maybe there's something else. That's happening, that's arising. And how beautiful, right? I mean, I really identify with what you're saying, having been sick also a month or so ago. And yeah, it's like the dog barking, the coughing, the not being able to breathe through my nose, the not hearing. No, I don't like this. And then being with the not liking it is where we have to enter. Yeah. Just really fully, I don't like it. I don't like it. What then arises? How could this be, this not liking it, also the great way manifesting itself? Kind of gives us all a break, you know, from that kind of judgment we habitually bring ourselves to. You know, I'm a Zen teacher. I shouldn't be upset about a dog barking or being sick. What's the deal here? But of course I am. I'm a human being with reactivity, and that's just baked in to the wonder. It really is. So thank you for naming that so clearly. Yeah, let's move on to Chad.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. So many things came to mind in this, but I think the part that struck me most was this aspect of, I think about all the lenses that I use that give me perception on things, whether it's like or not like or want or pain or joy or and all of that. And then that blade of grass was just like, it's like it cut them off my face. And so I could see the lenses without having to look through them. So instead of being stuck in, oh, I don't like this or I want that or otherwise, it's more like, oh yeah, I'm in that state, but it's all here at the moment. And to just kind of be with them. So it was very powerful, I think.
Yeah. And I think this is what Michael was pointing to earlier about, so it's not about saying I'm going to get rid of these lenses, because that's another lens, right? Then I have the lens of I have no lenses. but this appreciating, so this opening the heart is not something that, again, that's going to happen at some other time when you get to be a better Zen student or a better human being. The wondrous possibility of right now, oh yeah, I have this lens, I'm lost in this story, or I'm just noticing this story. then the stories too, each story, each lens itself is a blade of grass, is a wondrous creation, brilliant creation of the human mind. How intricate and subtle and holding this more open space you're talking about, where we really let things be.
And there seems to be a little bit of a near enemy there to identifying the lens, because that in this essence is we're removing ourselves from what's happening in our lives. We're saying, oh, that's because I'm looking at it through this lens, the lens of whatever. And opposed to possibly just realize, you know, things aren't looking the way they normally do right now. And completely being in that. Whether it's agitation, whether it's judgment, whether it's the judging mind or the objecting mind, as Jenny was saying.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And Pierce, last comment.
Well, everything is sufficient. Even this, what a radical thought, really. Everything is sufficient. Even this feeling of being tired and sleepy and disaffected and disconnected, that also is sufficient. How radical that is. And what an opportunity to practice that being sufficient, coming back to breath and body, so that it's not exclusively mine, but somehow it's the Dharma arising in the place where I happen to be, and also the opportunity to practice not comparing myself to others. Well, all I can say is I'm so happy I'm on Sesshin.
Yes, yes, exactly. And, you know, as you were talking, I was recalling times that this is so clear to me, this teaching, and I've always, as long as I can remember, tried to explicate it in Dharma talks and teachings, and people have gotten really angry about it. And I was just remembering one woman in particular. This was years ago. It was before I was an official teacher, but I was giving a talk. You know, I was a senior student. Just she was enraged. And then I thought about what Sean said. You know, all these spiritual teachers who are countercultural. This is countercultural. It's radical, as you said. It's not what the consensus reality teaches us is true. And for people who name it, it can cause a lot of distress in people. And that's like a normal thing our insistence on our own experience of this way can come across as just wrong, objectionable. And then you think about all the great spiritual teachers who were killed for what they taught, even the Buddha. You know, somebody gave him poisoned mushrooms at the end of his life. And of course, Jesus and so many other people. There's something objectionable about it. People cling so tight to their despair, to our despair and our anxiety. We cling so tight to it that this message can't come in. And as you say, being at Sesshin right now, what a radical thing to do. Here we are. And how glad I, you know, when I looked up at the screen before my Dharma talk and saw all your faces, I was just so thrilled. It was like looking at the pear blossoms. What an amazing thing that we've decided to do together. And even if the thing I'm saying now is hitting you like, what? No, not me. That's fine. Doesn't make any difference. Here we are being exposed to this radical, countercultural pointing to something much bigger than the consensus reality would allow us to experience. So I think with that, we'll bow and we'll go into whatever's next. Our practice leaders will take us there. Let's just come for a few breaths into our posture for Zazen.